Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Delighted to be here with you for 2 hours of open forum. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, if you want to know about Jesus, the Bible, the saints, the sacraments, you want to know about the moral teachings of the church, the doctrines of the church, whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest here to take your questions. I do want to stress, you don't have to be Catholic to call. If you've got something about the Catholic Church that you would like to know about, discuss, or maybe even that you'd like to challenge, you're very welcome. 888-318-7884. Joe, of course, is a very fine author, author of lots of books, including his newest one, The Eucharist is Really Jesus: How Christ's Body and Blood Are the Key to Everything We Believe. Joe Heschmeyer, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Have you been well? I ask particularly because you are a new parent, and I wonder if you're sleeping or anything, or you doing all right?
I'm so glad you asked that. I want listeners to know we did not set this up. This afternoon,
yes,
at 2:49, my wife texted me and said, I think Jimmy, that's our two-year-old, just flushed one of the nativity angels down the toilet downstairs.
Come on, Jimmy.
Taking care of the baby, and he thought it would be funny to see what would flush. And fortunately, thanks be to God, it did not flush. So
it was the angel. He probably just paddled his wings. Wouldn't go down. He fought it.
Yeah. So that's how Advent's going. That's how parenting is going more broadly.
Well, that's
there's
good.
A thousand such stories we could share, but some of them might not be appropriate for air.
Well, but they got the little baby too.
Yes, and we have a 2-month-old, a 2-year-old, and a 4-year-old.
It's
a joyful and chaotic experience, and sleep is a happy memory.
Not so joyful for the angel, probably, but for everybody
yeah,
else,
true.
It's probably all right.
This is why they were singing about Silent Nights and all that.
Yeah. 888-318-7884, the number 888-318-7884. Ask Joe whatever you like. It's open forum. And if it's got to do with the Catholic faith, we would love to talk about it. Joe's the author of other books as well, including The Early Church Was the Catholic Church and Pope Peter. And I think they're going to have a promo code. I asked Jen, because we're going on the cruise in June and we're inviting people to come, and you're going, Joe. She said they're going to have a discount on it through Christmas, I think through the early New Year. And I asked her to make the promo code Pope Peter. So, because I thought you would give it out more if it was Pope Peter.
That's smart.
So, I don't know if she did it, but people can try it.
So there may or may, so
it may, or may not be.
You are going and being like, I didn't get any discount for that. And that's a size mean joke.
But it's not it is not a joke. I tried, but it could be a failure, but it is not a joke. That's CatholicAnswersCruise.com, CatholicAnswersCruise.com, if you want to check out, come in. 888-318-7884, the number here. Already, Joe, all but one line full. Shall we just start right off and go to the phones? All right, let's start with Andrew, who is in Florida, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Andrew, thank you for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hi.
So I went to a Catholic priest and confessed the other day that I don't really believe this literally anymore to be true, the supernatural claims of the resurrection, but I would still like to be Catholic and take my family and raise them in the faith. Should I be excommunicated? Because I just kind of don't. I like the religion, and I wish it were true, but I don't really believe it.
Okay.
No, it's a good question. I'm really glad you asked that. I think it's a struggle to keep engaging in. It sounds like you've been on the struggle for a while, based on the way you worded that. And I would say, maybe you're not in a place where you can, in good faith, go forward for communion and say, I believe, and say amen, which is what I believe. Maybe, it means I believe. But there's something there that's still drawing you. And so I think you're not obstinately saying, I don't want this. You clearly do want that. And you think it's good for you and for your family. So maybe a good place to start would be to say, what is it that draws me to Jesus Christ and his church? And then build on that. Here he says these things that seem hard to believe. They were hard to believe 2,000 years ago. They're hard to believe today. And yet a lot of people believe them. And even people who don't believe them find themselves strangely drawn to the man at the center of this. How do we make sense of that? And so, I think maybe a good resource if you want a little bit of Advent reading. I might give you a copy of a book called A Teacher of Strange Things by a fellow by the name of Cy Kellett.
What? I think I'm going to tear up a little bit.
Because I think it's worth getting to the strangeness of Jesus, which can be both scandalizing and attractive. And it sounds like maybe in your life you've seen both sides of that. But this might help you go deeper on that. And so I would just say, stay open to the invitation for what God has for you, even in those areas where you say, right now, I can't say I believe in that. Just don't close that door. Leave it open and see if God brings you through it with a little more light.
What do you think? Do we lose our caller?
Yeah, I'm open. I'm open to, if God shows up or, you know, just if faith comes, you know, I wish it were. Definitely.
Well,
yeah, I think just say, you know, the prayer, you know, God, I want to love and honor you, and I have trouble with this, is something that can be a prayer made in good faith. One of my favorite prayers in the Bible is, Lord, I do believe, help my unbelief. Because it gets to that that really fascinating tension where you can say yes and still have some areas of struggle. And that being able to say that with authenticity and with faith, to just say, like, this is where I'm at, God honors that in a real way, and he does beautiful things with that.
Andrew, I'll tell you what, hang on, we'll send you a copy of the book. And as you kind of work your way through this, if you'd like to call back, maybe call back when Joe is on, but you're welcome to call any day. We'll keep a lookout for your call. But if you give an address to Edgar right now, we'll send you the book, A Teacher of Strange Things, Who Jesus Was, What He Taught, and Why People Still Follow Him. I hope we will get to talk again, Andrew. Thank you very, very much for the call. Another Andrew, this one in Utah, is next, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Andrew, number two, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hello, thank you. Try and put it as simply as I can. The short question is, what is a poll case in reference to conversion? I'm looking to be baptized into the church this Lent season. I'm unbelievably excited about that. My wife is not yet, but I think there's a strong possibility she will in like the next year or so. She was previously married 20 years ago for a very, very short time, and my priest was looking at what that means for me. This is my first and only marriage. It's gone on for 27 years, so it's pretty decent. My question is, we were looking at what needs to be done so that once I'm baptized, we can also go through a Catholic ceremony and be married. But he said there's going to be some troubles with that or some difficulties. But if she's interested in coming into the church, it may be easier to wait until she enters OCIA and begins her own process, because he said, quote, she becomes a poll case. And his limited English, he wasn't able to explain to me what that is. Does that make sense?
I'm not 100% sure what a poll case is. I'm wondering if this isn't a Paul, like Pauline privilege. Let me give you a little bit of the canon law that's relevant here. I'm not 100% sure what word the priest was saying there. So if you look at the Code of Canon Law in Canon 1143, there's rules about what to do if you have two unbaptized people, and then in favor of the faith, one of them, you know, becomes a Christian, and then the other person says, I'm not going to do it anymore, and they leave, that can be dissolved. And St. Paul actually talks about this, which is why it's called the Pauline privilege. It doesn't sound to me like that's what would be at issue here, although I don't know all the details in terms of whether your wife was baptized, whether the other person was, or any of those things. More likely, I think you'd be dealing with what's called a radical sanation, which is in Canon 1161. Forward, which is radical here, doesn't mean like extreme. It means a healing of the roots. So a sanation, like a healing, radical, this is of the roots. So it's healing the marriage from its beginning in terms of your marriage with her. If there was some kind of bar that can be, the church says, okay, you know, this first attempt at marriage that your wife had wasn't valid, and said this was never a true marriage, but this thing you've had for 27 years, we believe this is a marriage in the eyes of God. the church can declare that to be a valid marriage, not from the day that you guys decide to do the paperwork, but going back, healing it from the roots, from your original wedding day. And which gives people a lot of peace of mind and a lot of clarity that, no, we weren't like cohabitating for 27 years. We were actually married and we were actually doing the work of marriage. All of that stuff, yeah, the church will handle those things. And I wouldn't let any of that be a bar to you becoming Catholic. I would just say trust in the judgment and wisdom of the church in terms of sorting through the messiness that happens in people's lives when you know you have marriages and divorces and attempts at marriage and everything else.
Does that help you there, Andrew?
I think so. I think that sounds kind of like what he's talking about. He's a fantastic priest. He's getting better with his English and just has a little hard time with the more complex answers. But he just said that if she enters the program, it becomes so much easier. And made it.
Yeah, I think that's
like
true.
Yeah. Okay, no, that kind of puts a little more information in there. But no, we're going to move forward, and I think it'll be great. Thank you.
Well, wonderful. God bless you. Hey, is there anything you'd like in the way of books from Catholic Answers we could send your way?
Yeah, I've actually heard you mention a lot the book Why We're Catholic.
Yeah, well, if you stay on the line, we will send you Trent Horn's Why We're Catholic.
Andrew, please do hang on the line. Edgar will get an address there in Utah, and we will send it off to you. Thank you, Joe, for asking that. I should have asked that. And God bless you as you travel into full communion with the church at Easter, Andrew. We have to take a quick break. Right back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious mystic monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All mystic monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase mystic monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
He is honored by the church as one of the greatest enemies of clergy sexual abuse.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
In his time, St. Peter Damian fought against the many vices of contemporary clergy, especially sexual abuses among the clergy. In 1051, he wrote the Book of Gomorrah that is still considered essential reading for fighting abuse today. He died in 1072.
To find out more, visit EWTN.com and click on Catholicism.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Our guest is Joe Heschmeyer, and it's an open forum. You can call and ask whatever you like. And already, tough questions for Joe on marriage and what to do when you've lost faith in the supernatural. If you have an easy question, you can call too. They don't all have to be hard for Joe. You can give him a break. 888-318-7884 is the number. We'll go to Nebraska next. Jack is up there in Nebraska listening on 102.7 FM. Jack, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. I just had a question. I was recently reading scripture, and I just wanted to know kind of how, Jesus said the living and the dead will be judged. So I'm just curious as how the dead are judged. I know I kind of understand the living aspect of it. I'm just curious as to, regardless of it, if they're in heaven or hell, How is the dead judged on the day of judgment after the second coming?
Okay.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So scripture speaks of judgment in two ways. First, as Hebrews says, after death, there's judgment. You know, this is what we call the particular judgment, that when you die at the moment of death, you are eternally saved or damned. And nothing you do from that point forward is going to change that outcome. But there's also another judgment spoken of called the last judgment. And Matthew 25, we see Christ comes and he separates the sheep and the goats. And he explains to all the cosmos why these people were saved and these ones were damned. And so it's not that you have a change of location then, but that you and everyone around you has a deeper appreciation for how all these pieces fit together. Because one thing to say, so-and-so's a saint, but to know, like, well, why is that person a saint is a different question. And maybe they don't understand fully themselves, because certainly in Matthew 25, one of the reactions we see from both the saved and the damned is a sense that they're kind of surprised that they ended up where they did. You know, when did we see you and either do or not do the things we're supposed to do? So I would kind of point to that, that there's, we are judged at the moment of death, but there's also a last judgment that Scripture speaks of pretty clearly. All of this is talked about, by the way, in the Catechism, in the early 1000s section. So the particular judgment is 1021 to 1022, and then last judgment is 1038 onward.
Okay, cool. I just had one more question. You don't have to elaborate because I know you got probably a bunch of calls. Feel free to if you'd like, but do Catholics believe in the Book of Life, kept in heaven from what I've read?
Oh, like when you talk about the Lamb's Book of Life and the Book of Revelation, or is it some other thing?
Basically, what I've thought or I've read is the Book of Life is basically a list of people. Like they keep the names of people, of people who are destined for heaven. That's basically it. I don't know if it's a Catholic view or not. I read this online, so that's a red flag for me. But just the Book of Life. It just says that there's a list of people kept in heaven, basically who can enter heaven or who are in heaven.
So there's references to this in the Book of Revelation. So for instance, in Revelation 17, it refers to those whose names have not been written in the Book of Life from the foundation of the world. Revelation 20, 21, and 22 all mention anyone's name not found in the Book of Life, he's thrown in the lake of fire. Those who enter into heaven are those whose names are written in the Book of Life. There's an open question as to whether we're talking something literally like a book or whether this is a figurative kind of image, because we're talking about in heaven. You know, are we saying there's literal parchment and ink, or what does this book mean? But there is some sense, certainly, in which God knows who are saved and who are not saved. The other question this raises and doesn't answer is, can someone go from being in the book to not being in the book, or the other way around? The problem, if you say no, it seems to me, if you say everyone whose name is written in the book, it's always been in there, you can't add or remove any names, etc. The danger with that view is, then does a person ever get saved during their lifetime? You see what I mean? So if you went to heaven because your name was on a book written before you were born, then it's not clear to me, I guess I should say, how faith plays a role. Or how believing in Jesus does anything, or being incorporated to the church, or any of those things that Scripture speaks of as being saving. Well, it seems like they weren't really saving, that being in the book was what saved you, not anything else like believing in Jesus. But if the book is a recognition of who will ultimately say yes and who will ultimately say no, then we could talk about it in that way. So all that's to say, there is this reference in the Book of Revelation to a Book of Life, and then there are people who make guesses about what that means. And we believe in the Book of Life. We don't necessarily share those guesses.
Ah, what do you think about that? Does that make sense to you, Jack?
Yeah, that makes sense. And that totally makes sense, especially with regarding, you know, the changes of heart of severe sinners, where if you're predetermined, if you're written in that book before you're even born, that doesn't make sense to me at all, because there's plenty of people who have gone down rough paths who have changed their lives. Turn their lives around and follow Jesus, who have been saved.
Right.
Apparently. So, yeah. Actually, the most recent episode of Shameless Popery, my podcast, looks at, can a Christian lose their salvation? And there are a lot of Christians who say no, but Scripture actually has plenty of places that say yes. And those passages that seem to say no, I think, are being misread. So it's like an hour-long episode. I'm not going to try to recap it all there, except to say, if this is a subject you're interested in, if you look up Shameless Popery, it's the most recent episode, and you can go listen to it.
Do look up Shameless Popery. You can find out all about it at shamelessjoe.com. Really increasing in listeners. It's not very old. How long have you been doing it, Joe? 6 months?
Just about 1 year, actually.
Oh, a year. And lots of people finding it. So please check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Thank you, Jack. Thank you very much for the call. We're going to Seoul, South Korea, where Luke, of all of the Nigerians living in South Korea that call, Luke is our favorite Nigerian living in South Korea. Luke, nice to talk to you again. Hello, Luke.
I don't know if you're his favorite host.
I know. I'm on line four. No, that's not Luke. We're going to have to come back. I do not want to lose Luke because we don't get a lot of calls from South Korea. So,
what does it profit man to lose his own soul?
So we lost
South Korea. Yeah.
Joe, normally the punning, no. But this one, yes. 100% yes. Wait, go to line four? Are you telling me go to line four? Okay. And back we go to line four. Luke, are you there with us?
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Hello, Luke. Nice to talk with you again. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hello, Joe. Good morning. All right, I'll be fine. Hello?
No, we got you. We got you, Luke. We're going to be super quiet. Let you ask your question from Seoul, South Korea. Pray that it goes over the satellite clearly, and then we'll get you an answer. Go ahead, Luke.
All right. How do you explain to a non-Christian, especially a Muslim, that Jesus is God and also the Son of God?
Beautiful. Did you hear that clearly, Joe?
I did.
Okay.
How do we explain to a non-Christian, especially a Muslim, that Jesus is God and the Son of God?
Yeah.
I would say I would start with the idea that God is love. God doesn't just love. He is love. This is really key to the Christian understanding of God. And this is something that I think is very beautiful and is very attractive, even for many non-Christians. And the nature of love is selfless. So if God doesn't just love, but is love from all eternity before the creation of the world, that suggests that within God, there is this movement of love, of lover and beloved. And so this is pointing to this reality we call the Trinity. Now, that's not a reality we could have ever come to on our own. But once we hear it, it's like, aha, this explains how God can be love rather than just loving, that he is this interpersonal dynamic of love. That's still hard to wrap one's mind around, but I think that's actually a good thing. And here's why I say that. If it was really easy to wrap our minds around it, that would raise some suspicions that it was made up. Right. Like if I tell you a story or, you know, paint you a picture, you can say, oh, yeah, I can understand that. It sounds very much like something a human made up because a human did make it up. But if instead it's describing this thing that is almost beyond words, well, that sounds much more like the true story. So there's a great respect for Allah in Islam. But it strikes me that in many of the characteristics ascribed to him, he just seems like a bigger and better version of us, where with the Christian description of God, there's not just the sense of a bigger, better version of us, although there's some of that, but also there's something radically other in God, something that's actually very different. You know, I'm one person in one nature. And so this belief in a God who's three persons in one nature goes so far beyond my realm of experience and existence that I have to say, this doesn't seem like a story from Earth. This feels like a story from elsewhere. Which I don't know. I hope that's helpful. But that's kind of the Trinity writ large. And then Jesus comes along and he repeatedly claims to be the Son of God. And yeah, that is shocking. And yeah, it's controversial. And yeah, it's even scandalous. That's a major part of the story. The Muslims believe in what's called the Injil, that Jesus wrote his own gospel. But to believe that all of this stuff was, you know, a later addition strikes me as fundamentally unbelievable as history goes. If you're trying to tell the story of Jesus, why would you make it harder to believe if you're going to evangelize? Why would you add all these parts that everyone says, wait, what? He's not just a prophet, but he's the Son of God. How does that work? And so I think all the evidence points to this being early and authentic. You have both the early New Testament writings and the copies that we have. You have the early other Christian attestations. So the best historical evidence, and one of the good reasons we believe Jesus is God and Son of God, is Jesus, who Christians and Muslims both believe in, claimed to be God and the Son of God in the earliest records we have. So there's much more that could be said, but that's what I'd say to that.
Luke, thank you. I'm not going to go back to Luke just because we're having connection troubles, but thank you very much for the call, Luke. Appreciate it. I hope that was helpful to you, and we really do enjoy it when you call. He's calling from, what would it be, Thursday morning. in Seoul, South Korea. Sean's in Port Perry, Canada, where it is Wednesday afternoon or Wednesday evening. Sean's listening on that device, the name of which we do not speak, but you just say her name, and then she does what you want her to do, I guess. I don't have one myself. But Sean, glad to have you. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
I just told Edgar I was listening on the A word device.
The A word, yes, right.
So,
I didn't look at the clock, Sean. I messed up. The music's playing. Can you hang on just a quick second?
Oh, of course I can.
I apologize for that. All right. I'm glad it was a Canadian, though, because they're always nice about it, no matter what. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answers' own Carlo Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carlo's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Open Forum. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. And on the line from Canada, our friend Sean, who that was not one of my best moments there, Sean, introducing you and then having to go right to the break. But I'm glad you're here.
Right.
Go ahead with your question for Joe.
So, Joe, as you aware, of course, the language that was spoken by the ancient Jewish people, or Israelites, I guess they were called before Judah and Israel split, was Hebrew. But around the time that Jesus lived, many or most or a great number of Jewish people spoke Aramaic. What is Aramaic? Where did it come from? And why did the Jewish people switch from Hebrew to Aramaic?
Yes, good question. So Aramaic's another Semitic language, so it's very closely related to Hebrew. They're like mutually intelligible. So there's a much bigger question about what makes a language compared to a dialect. For instance, Cantonese and Mandarin and Chinese, we call them both dialects of Chinese, but someone speaking Mandarin usually can't understand someone speaking Cantonese, but they can read each other's writing. So it's pretty strange. I think Hebrew and Aramaic are actually closer than that. For instance, when you see Jesus crying out to the Father on the cross, it's whether it's he's saying Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, or Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. So it's literally a change of like one letter. I mean, they're very close. It is, if you think of Israel as the United States, the Aramean people would be basically Canada. You know, they're just to the north of Israel. And so the Neo-Assyrian Empire spreads that language. And so it becomes, you first see it in the Old Testament, I believe in the book of Daniel. There are sections that are in Aramaic rather than in Hebrew. And it becomes kind of the common language. And so it has this, I think originally, it's like the trade language, the lingua franca, across the Neo-Assyrian Empire. By the days of Jesus in the first century, it doesn't really have that status anymore, but it's still commonly spoken by the regular people now. So that's kind of the transition that it makes. That makes sense?
Hello?
Sean, does that make sense to you?
Oh, yeah, of course. I never understood where Aramaic came from. That's what I wanted to ask. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Yeah, you bet.
Thank you. We got to hear some Aramaic yesterday. It was our retreat, our Advent retreat and retreat for the Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe. The Mass was celebrated by a Chaldean priest. Man, it was beautiful, too. It was great. And when you go to the Chaldean Mass, they say the words of consecration, they use not just the words of Jesus, but the language of Jesus to say those words. It's really something. I highly recommend, if you get a chance, go to a Chaldean Mass. Let's go to Ricky in Bellevue, Nebraska, listening on Catholic.com. Ricky, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, good evening, guys. Joe, my question is kind of broken up into three parts. Number one, I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce it right. Who is John Hus or Jan Hus? Jan Hus, thank you. Why was he put to death, and does his example in life pose a problem for someone like me who's not a Catholic?
Pose a problem in what way?
As in, okay, does his example show errors in magisterial teaching and authority, and therefore that would keep someone from becoming a Catholic?
Oh, okay, good. I get the question. That makes sense. So Jan Hus is sometimes called the morning star of the Reformation. He is a precursor to Martin Luther, so 15th century. He is a lot more specific to his time and place, I think, than Luther is, because a lot of what he's complaining about are particular kind of bohemian issues in terms of a lot of their bishops are Germans, and they want them to be Czechs or, you know, bohemians. And so it's just a lot of that weird kind of local politics stuff that we're never totally immune from as human beings, but that isn't really of eternal importance. I hope that makes sense. There are a lot of teachings he has that later reformers will agree with, but that the Catholic Church rejects. So one of the things he says is that the only people who are in the church are the saved. And a lot of Protestants believe that today. This is completely unbiblical. And it makes Jan Hus argue that Judas wasn't really a bishop, but he was an apostle. And once you start saying that, it just, like, that ecclesiology, you know, that view of the church doesn't make sense. To say one of the 12 is actually an apostle, but is not actually a bishop, he's not actually part of the church he's an apostle of, it doesn't make a tremendous amount of sense. And so he's wrong on a lot of things. And so the Council of Constance condemns him in terms of his errors. There's commonly the claim that the Catholic Church burns him at the stake. This isn't actually true. The Council of Constance said, this Holy Synod of Constance, seeing that God's church has nothing more that it could do, relinquishes Jan Hus to the judgment of the secular authority and decrees that he is to be relinquished to the secular court. So the church turns him over to the secular state. And the Holy Roman Empire actually puts him to death because the Holy Roman Empire didn't want him disturbing the peace. This speaks to a way of viewing the world that most of us don't really view the world in this way anymore. But at the time, the idea of someone preaching a false religion was viewed as a threat to secular stability, security, and not without reason, right? Like when the Protestant Reformation comes, I don't know if we really consider this, but it isn't just like, oh, some people changed their ideas about religion. Like, no. Europe was descended into more than a century of bloody infighting. At the same time that there's like a large Islamic invasion from the East, and all of Christianity was really threatened because Christians are attacking other Christians. The Holy Roman Empire is kind of up in flames. You have, you know, all of these regional conflicts and national conflicts, and you have these massive wars brought about by people having these differences in beliefs about religion. Because at the heart of the claim of the rulers is ultimately they're there because it's the will of God for them to be there. And so if you say that and you're a Catholic and then everyone in your country becomes, you know, a Hussite or a Protestant or whatever, it creates more national instability. So I don't say any of that to support, you know, killing people who are different religions. I say that simply to say, when the Holy Roman Empire kills Jan Hus, this isn't a disproof of the Catholic Church. This is just a recognition that secular politics in the days of Jan Hus were very different than they are today. You know, you wouldn't see that happening these days. But the church was right to say that Hus's theology was wrong and that he shouldn't continue to present himself as a Catholic priest.
What do you think?
Yeah, well, there's quite a lot there. Was there any involvement, Joe, if I could ask a follow-up, on Jan Hus giving pushback on withholding one or both sets of communion from the laity?
So this is one of the major things that he argues, that you have to offer the laity the chalice as well as the host. And it's fine to offer both. Certainly in the history of the church, especially in the East, that's regularly done. As you have that done today. But the idea that it has to be done misunderstands something about the nature of communion. And so it's fine if someone says, really, we ought to offer both. I've got no beef with someone who says that. But someone who says it's required, now they've made a claim that isn't defensible, isn't correct. And so, yeah, this is one of the many issues that there's a lot of back and forth on. And some people find that to be an extremely significant one, and some people find it to be less important. I mean, today, if you want to receive from the chalice as well, in almost any church, you can. So it's not really a live issue as far as I see it, but it certainly was a bigger deal in the early 1400s.
Ricky, thank you very much for the call. We don't get a lot of opportunity to talk about Jan Hus. It's very interesting. Appreciate it. We'll have one line open as we go to the break. You're welcome to fill it if you've got a question about the Catholic faith. It's an open forum. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. 888-318-7884 is the number.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Renowned Catholic literary scholar Joseph Pierce introduces you to the men and women behind history's greatest works of literature. You can hear The Authority with Joseph Pierce, as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates across the nation, all in one place, all free, at EWTN Podcast Central. Visit EWTNradio.net/podcasts today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Hey, we'd love it if you'd come with us to cruise down the St. Lawrence Seaway from Montreal through all the Catholic country of Canada there, Quebec in particular, and then out into the Atlantic Ocean and around to Boston. We're going to do that in June 29th to July 6th on the Holland-America lines. And Joe's coming. Father Paul Keller, who you hear sometimes here, is coming. Chris is coming. I'll be there. And then Doctors William and Amy Fahey will be there as well, giving talks on that part of the world, on the Catholic faith in North America. We're going to have a great time. If you want to know more about it, go to CatholicAnswersCruise.com. CatholicAnswersCruise.com. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest here, not wearing flannel today because it's not a flannel panel, but look at this.
You're rocking it, yeah.
I rocked the flannel. I should say I did.
I like that you say accidentally.
Well, it's not like I did intentionally put clothes on. I didn't think through that when I put it on this morning, Joe's going to be here and I'll be wearing flannel. It just seemed warmer than my other shirts. All right, let's go to Eric in Indiana, watching on YouTube. Eric, we're awful glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, guys. I called last week in regards to New Age Prophets, and I feel like I misrepresented my coworker. He had told me in confidence that he was he believed that he was a prophet.
Okay.
And
I remember the call.
Yeah. Don't give us his name.
Yeah. So, yeah, pretty much it wasn't like anything to like say, hey, give me praise. He gave praise to God, and that's kind of like he believed he got a gift from God.
Okay.
He was telling me that in private. So does that change, like, how do we discern people who do this in private versus people of ill intent?
Yeah, I think it changes it in one sense. If somebody seems like they have a motive to lie about it, then you want to factor that in. I mean, the way you would with anything else. If somebody tells you they've got a way to make money and you notice that it seems to benefit them a lot and not you, well, that's a red flag, and you should consider that in your discernment. So, you know, 1 John chapter 4, verse 1 says, "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they're of God, for many false prophets have gone out into the world." And Peter describes those who are both ignorant as well as corrupt, twisting the scriptures. So it's possible both for someone to act in bad faith or under demonic influence, or for them just to be naive or ignorant or think God's calling them when he's not calling them. All of those things are possible. You don't even have to assume bad faith. It's still possible someone's just misunderstood what God was saying to them, or mistook their own thoughts as the thoughts of God. And so we need to be very discerning in response to that. And so anytime you see a red flag, like, well, this person, it seems about ego or something like that, then yeah, that's a big red flag. In this case, maybe that red flag isn't there. That doesn't automatically mean that they're telling the truth. And even if they are telling the truth and say no, but it doesn't mean that they're right. So we want to still be kind of mindful of all of that. We're not looking for any new revelation from God, because the full revelation has come in Jesus Christ. There may be insights that God gives prophetically to people, but those you can really take or leave. And so we don't build the whole edifice on that. And we don't put a ton of stock in any of that, because that's not what Christ came to give us. So as you're, you know, considering prophetic kind of claims, I would say always take all of these claims with a grain of salt if they've not been approved by the church. And I always err on the side of, I'm going to trust the stuff God has already given us over the stuff that's of more dubious province.
Does that
make sense?
Yeah, definitely. It makes sense. I just thought I'd come on here and ask that question, because I do feel like I misrepresented him.
Oh, we don't know your coworker. Your secret is safe with us.
Yeah. I appreciate that.
Yeah. I would like your heart to be settled about this. Is there anything else you wanted to ask Joe, or do you feel comfortable with it there?
I feel comfortable with that. I do have another question, though, if possible.
All right. Let's see. That would be $7. I'm just kidding, Eric. Sorry. Oh, he took that seriously. I was only joking, Eric. Go ahead with your question.
So what would it take for the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church to come in union with
small
each other?
Here's a little, little something for you, Joe.
Good question. On paper, the major issues are things like the filioque and the role of the Pope. There, I think beneath that are a lot of other political and national and ethnic issues that are long and complicated, about just the fact that Greek and Latin Christianity grew up separate from each other. They have different stories in some ways, and they have a sometimes contentious relationship. So about a tenth of Eastern Christians are Eastern Catholics. But there's a lot of issues at hand. So our friend Michael Lofton just wrote a book on this subject called Answering Orthodoxy. So if you stay on the line we'll send you that book, and that'll be a much fuller kind of answer to the question that I can kind of give in this time span.
Eric, hang on the line, because we would love to send you Michael Lofton's new book, Answering Orthodoxy, A Catholic Response to Attacks from the East. And it's getting rave reviews as well. So I hope, well, you can call back and tell us what you think of it. Hang on, and we'll get your address, and we'll send it off to you. Let's go to, London, England. My favorite of all the Londons. Claire is in London, England, watching on YouTube. Claire, welcome.
Hello.
How are you listening to us? Oh, YouTube. Oh, you got us on YouTube there in London. Well, we're awful glad you found us.
Yeah, I always listen to your show.
You do, really?
Yeah, I love it. It really helped me to find Catholicism and become Catholic.
Praise God. How did you find us in London? Like, I know EWTN is on the air over there. But how did you find us?
I think I literally just stumbled on the channel, actually. I was just searching for Catholic YouTubers, and it came up 2.5 years ago. And now I'm Catholic, so really happy.
Do you think you could become a regular caller? Because your accent really classes the place up. I mean, really brings the whole thing up.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. I definitely think you're classing it up. All righty then, go ahead with your question.
I'm so sorry. What? Have you ever seen Dick Van Dyke's performance of a British accent in Mary Poppins?
I thought that.
Yeah, I used to watch Mary Poppins as a kid.
Wait, but now that accent that I just did, you kind of thought it was a British guy, didn't you? You didn't think that was me, did you, Claire?
Well. It didn't sound that British to me, because I am British, but I guess for an American, it sounds British.
All right. Blimey, Claire. Yeah. All right, I can't. I clearly am not going to be able to do that. go ahead with your question, Claire, and please call a lot to class this place up.
We'll try not to let him bother you next time.
Okay, I wanted to ask a question about Isaac and Rebecca, because I was having a debate with a Muslim recently, and... They kind of were trying to tell me that Islam was like the way, the truth, and the life, and whatever. And I was like, no, it's not. And then they started bringing up that Isaac married Rebecca when she was 3 years old. And I don't remember reading that in the Bible.
No.
And I just wanted to find out if that's true or what.
I think I'd have remembered that.
Yeah, no. There's pretty good reason to believe that's not true. So go back to Genesis 24. And she's described as a woman, which is not how one would describe a three-year-old. So her age is not given. Isaac's age is given. He's 40. She's probably younger than him, but not three. So we don't know how old she is.
Yeah. So I found that really strange. And apparently,
that is very
strange. A lot of Muslims do think it's. I'd never heard that before, like among Catholics or other Christians.
No, so there's different Jewish traditions on the matter. One tradition says she's 14, but these are, they're not based in anything from even within centuries of when this was written. So I wouldn't give a lot of stock into like later Talmudic claims about it. The simple answer is we don't have that information, and anybody claiming that information is making it up. They're adding things that aren't in the Bible and that we don't have any reason to believe we have knowledge of.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought it was just a load of rubbish. Like, I'd never heard of that before.
Rubbish. Yeah. That's what I would say. Rubbish. That was going to be the word I was going to use. Rubbish. That's a...
a load of rubbish.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question, Claire? Do you think we should have more or fewer imitations of guest accents on this show?
Right then.
you can always do more if you like.
Oh, my favorite.
You are the epitome of class, and I appreciate your long-suffering disposition.
Thanks, Claire. You really did class the place up. Thanks for the call.
Thanks for answering my questions.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right, bye-bye.
God bless you.
You know, I got to just tell you this, Joe, before we go to the next caller. Zach thought it would be funny. He got a book. I think he might have got it from Amazon called Introduction to Radio Announcing or something like that. But, okay? And then he highlighted the part where it said, before you speak, make sure it's really funny. Like, ask yourself, like, stop and ask yourself, is this really funny? And then he
tell Zach that's not fair. We cannot have 2 hours of dead air.
That's mean. So then he highlighted that part that they all think it's hilarious in there that this book is here. So while we're talking to Claire, Darren gets the book out and starts reading it right in front of me. And he's like pointing to that part before you speak. I apologize, Claire, and everyone else in the British Isles. But thank you for the call. Yeah, before you speak, make sure it's really funny.
Okay.
All right, thanks, guys. Let's go to Donald in Central Jersey. It doesn't even say New Jersey, just Central Jersey. I like that. Listening.
That
on...
might be another English.
Oh, he could be. No. It could be it could be Jersey, like the island.
Either way, okay. Don't make fun of the accent. Whatever's about to happen.
All right, Donald, be careful with this accent. We're really going for classy today. All right, go ahead, Donald, with your question.
I'll try. I don't have really a Jersey accent. I come from northern New Jersey.
Oh.
I just moved down here, but I'll give it my best.
You're doing good. You sound good.
Okay. Do I have a Jersey accent?
No, I wouldn't say that. No, I would not have thought that you had it. And I will not attempt to do the Jersey accent. But you sound nothing like Bruce Springsteen.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, all right. Go ahead.
I was wondering what the view is of the authenticity of the Crown of Thorns. And, for instance, I've gone to many midnight masses on Christmas, and they've had a cross with a little splinter behind a bubble of glass.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the authenticity of those things?
Yeah, that's a good question. There was a claim, I believe it was John Calvin made, where he said if you put all the pieces of the true cross together, you could build a ship or something like this. I think Erasmus said something similar. But that's not true. And in fact, they've done, like non-Catholic scholars, have investigated this and just figured out, well, if you were to take all of the alleged pieces of the true cross, well, it still wouldn't even come to like a fifth of the size of the cross as it probably was. So all that's to say, we can't just discount the relics of the true cross. This is an issue where a Catholic is not required to believe in the authenticity, but I think there are really good reasons to believe in the authenticity in this sense. That you would imagine that if Christians are following Jesus from the time of Christ, and if they have this tremendous appreciation for the role of the cross, you know, St. Paul says, I proclaim Christ and him crucified. You know, we preach the cross, this kind of thing. Well, it makes sense that they would preserve the cross. They would know where it was. And so as you follow the cross throughout history, you find some early inscriptions claiming to have parts of the cross. And then the Byzantine emperor has it for a while. And so it's people who, or, you know, has fragments of the cross, it has the crown of thorns. These things, it makes sense that the most powerful kind of Christians would have those things. And then they end up in places that you would expect them to end up, places like Rome. From there, they're often donated or given. You know, you can't charge for them. That's a sin. But you can give a relic of the true cross as a gift to someone who's going to venerate it or put it in a church. And so actually we know of a priest connected with Catholic Answers who received a relic of the true cross in this way. He had assisted a monastic community and they had a relic of the true cross and they knew he would honor and respect it and venerate it. And so they gave it to him. So all that's to say, I can't tell you every individual claimed piece of the true cross is the real deal, but I believe that overwhelmingly, like when you see relics of the true cross, that what they claims to be it is, because it makes sense for it to be, and the usual kind of skeptical takes, I just don't find particularly convincing. But again, having said all that, a Christian is free to disagree with that prudential assessment.
And we'll have to leave it there because the music is playing. Joe, will you be back for another hour or are you knackered?
I'm happy to come.
All right, good.
I'm less happy to come now, but I'll still be here.
Well, are you gonna fancy a cuppa while you have this little break here now? Because
I would be
just chuffed to bits if you would come back.
I am amazing. You're getting so many of these so quickly.
All right, mate. We're going to take a bit of a quick break. And I opened up a website that says common British phrases. That was
okay.
So I was trying to get through all of them before I went to the break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.